When you are authentically you, when you don't feel like you have to hide yourself, when you feel like you don't have to have a part of you that you're ashamed of or keeping secrets from the rest of the world, no one can hurt you. That's a key part of leadership.
Welcome to the Unstoppable Woman podcast, where we explore what it means to create a truly exquisite life. I'm your host, Amira Alvarez, inviting you to be part of these intimate conversations about feminine ambition, what lies beyond traditional notions of success, and how to answer the question, what's next when you've already achieved so much? Let's dive in.
Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Unstoppable Woman podcast. I'm Amira Alvarez. I am the founder and CEO of the Unstoppable Woman, and so excited that you are here listening to the podcast today. We have a great guest on that I'm super excited to interview. Her name is Elise Bowie, and she is the founder, CEO of Elise Bowie Family Law Firm. And she's also from New Orleans, where I just was for a brief overnight trip with my mother and sister, which was super fun. And we, before we got this recording going, we were just talking about living in the South. So all of you are going to pick right up in the middle of this conversation. And we're going to be talking to Elise about moving across the country, living in the South, family, what that means to building a business and the work you do in this world, and then also what it means to be unstoppable as a woman in business, and diving into her story, which has everything to do with New Orleans as well. So welcome to the podcast, Elise.
Thanks so much for having me. I really am excited to talk to you. And I think it's funny that we have that kind of joint move around the country story.
I know. So before we hit record, we were having that sort of pre-podcast record convo that happens where you're sort of getting to know each other and understanding the context of the conversation. And we were talking about where I was from and where I moved. And she had the previous move, which was many, many years ago. Well, I shouldn't say that many years ago, but 2018. And I was like, oh, you did your research. And she was like, uh-huh. And so I gave her the short story of my moves across the country, which I will now share with you as context, dear listeners. So I grew up in California, in Southern California, and then moved to the Bay Area to go to school at UC Berkeley. And I just stayed. I love the Northern California vibe. I spent 25 plus years there. In my 40s, I moved across the country to Wisconsin and lived there for 6 years. And there's a little short story. If you we'll put a link to it in the show notes. But I did this wild and crazy thing where I sold my house in the Berkeley Hills in a month and Craigslisted everything in our lives and bought a Sprinter van and drove across the country for 7 months with my then husband and 70-pound, 80-pound Labradoodle in this small little Sprinter van with solar panels on the roof. But if you're looking at me on YouTube, you will see that I have shiny gold earrings on, and I don't look like I would be someone who would spend 7 months in a van. Okay. And Elise is laughing here. I'm trying to shorten this story. My mother, when I told her, was like, oh my God, you're going to be destitute under a bridge, and I'm going to have to come save you, when I told her what we were doing. But we had a great time. We saw a lot of amazing things. I tell my story in on the blog from years and years and years ago. That was 2012. And ended up in Wisconsin. Then my then husband and I, Jack, got a divorce. He's a great guy. It was a great marriage until it wasn't. And then we went our separate ways. And I ended up in Colorado, which is where Elise found my story. And then moved to Charlotte. And she was asking me how I like Charlotte. And I actually love Charlotte. I didn't for a long time. I was like, why am I here? I'm a Californian. What am I doing here? But I just went to California recently. this, I'm just like sharing everything that I just shared with her behind the scenes and to look at moving there. And I didn't find any place I wanted to move or like. We looked at houses, we looked at rentals. It just didn't land. And I was like, even though I grew up here, there's a vibe that I didn't really, really love. And it made me appreciate Charlotte so much more, the ease, the just down to earthness of it, and the ease of living and the zero traffic in comparison. So Elise, that was a long me talking for a setup for you, but you were like, oh yeah, me too. And you're from the South, from New Orleans. So talk about your move story.
Well, I lived in New Orleans my whole life. You know, I mean, I born and raised, lived there forever. I left for college, but went to college in Tennessee, you know, then back to New Orleans. So always in the South. Then crazy old Hurricane Katrina hit. And, you know, at the moment, we weren't planning to move. I mean, my ex, who was my husband at the time, we had looked at moving to Wisconsin. So it's kind of interesting. You mentioned living in Wisconsin. We had this dream of moving to Madison, Wisconsin. It just looked like such a cool place to live. And we were going to move there. But, you know, at the time the hurricane hit, we had no plans to move. But obviously we had to move. I mean, the city was, you know, pretty much underwater and pretty decimated. So we evacuated, you know, the day before Hurricane Katrina. We ended up in Georgia, where my ex-husband's family is from, kind of landed on their doorstep. I can say they were not so excited to get, you know, the son, the daughter-in-law, four kids, and, you know, three pets. Like, they were like, what? What are you doing? So we did live there for approximately a year, though. And we, you know, kind of tried on the idea of living in Georgia, but they live not like in Atlanta. They live in this rural area of Georgia. And I came to understand in that time that New Orleans was not the normal South. Like, I thought I was a good Southern girl. I was a good New Orleans girl. That is very different than the rest of the South. And so it was this.
Wait, pause there. What makes a good New Orleans girl? You got to answer that question.
Well, I mean, a good New Orleans girl loves people, loves food, loves partying, loves, you know, good drinks, loves the hospitality of the area, is completely comfortable with the racial diversity of New Orleans. Like, you know, it's just part of your daily thing where you are constantly interacting with people from all different cultures and all different walks of life. When we moved to rural Georgia, it was pretty segregated. I mean, it was like, you know, we would go to my in-law's church. I mean, my ex-father-in-law is a Baptist minister. And when we first went to a church, I was like, why does everyone in this church have blonde hair? Like, how can this be? And so, you know, then he explained, well, we kind of go to different churches. I was like, what are we talking about? Like, is this a real thing? Because in New Orleans, that is not as common. You know, there's much more just coexistence. And so that became a real issue for me, I think, because I was concerned about what in the world I would be, you know, teaching my children. And so we decided that we were going to move up to the Midwest. We didn't move to Wisconsin, but we did move to the Twin Cities. And so we lived in the Twin Cities for 5 years and, you know, were able to reestablish ourselves because obviously, well, not obvious. I mean, both my ex and I were attorneys. And when the hurricane hit, you know, if you don't have a license in another state, it's not like you can go practice law. You've got to retake bar exams and the whole, you know, kit and caboodle. So we both kind of got all resettled and, you know, got our licenses in place and did that. And then we were able to divorce. I mean, we had talked divorce right before the Hurricane Katrina hit. But when the hurricane hit, we were like, obviously, this would not be the prime moment for divorce. We're going to need to, you know, work this out and just kind of live together peacefully while we resettle.
Hey there. I just want to take a quick moment and ask, what's the thing holding you back from your own success? The hidden shadow or saboteur potentially at play for you? And do you know how to find it? We often have that one thing keeping us from our next level. And it's not always the strategic move. It's often the internal one. I found in my own journey of success in building my exquisite life, it's what I call a core wound or loyalty pack. What's that? I share more at theunstoppablewoman.com.
right on the homepage. Find out more at theunstoppablewoman.com. Now, let's get back to our episode.
Okay, let's dig into some of those things. So you knew ahead of time that you were on your way to separation, but after the hurricane, you thought that was not a good idea. And was that because of the kids?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
We had four children, you know, like nine and under. I mean, yeah. And well, and we both had to get licenses. Do you know, like we would literally have been unemployed and it would have been a big mess to try to create two homes in an evacuation mindset. So we just stayed together and kind of lived together, you know, almost like roommates.
And how was that? How did that affect your, let's just go there if you don't mind. I'm just going to dig in, but you can not answer anything you don't want. Like how did this, the energy of living as roommates affect your life force, affect your enthusiasm for life, your vigor to go do things, not just do things, but you as a woman?
I mean, that is such a good question, which no one has ever asked me. It is such a good question, though. And it's interesting. At first, it felt unifying that we were doing what we needed to do for our children. So I kind of felt responsible and like, you know, I was being a good mom in a crisis, like, you know, doing the thing. After about a year or two, like once we settled in Minnesota, it became much more clear that it was toxic. You know, that I walked on eggshells some, you know, some of the reason for why we were divorcing, you know, obviously was still right there in our face all the time. And it became very difficult. And so I really shrank myself in a massive way to try not to, you know, ruffle feathers, get him upset, you know, just cause extra stress. Now, obviously, if you were interviewing him, he might not agree that I was doing a good job of that. But I was trying to, you know, just kind of keep the peace. And by keeping the peace, that meant I was stuffing myself in a box regularly.
And what did that look like so that people can relate to that or not, like can sure. Filter? This is stuffing myself in a box and this is not. Right.
I mean, stuffing myself in a box was like, I would want to volunteer and be, you know, I was always into like, you know, government kind of things. I'm a lawyer, you know, what can we do? We love all that. So I would want to volunteer for like, you know, the swim team, this or that. He would just be relentless. Like, you know, why do you have to go to this? And why do you have to go to this meeting? And then I would feel so guilty because I was doing some kind of civic thing. And at the time I wasn't working, I was, you know, homeschooling my kids, taking care of the kids. And so it was kind of like an outlet for me, you know what I mean, to do adult things and work on adult issues. And he was very much not supportive of that to the point where, you know, I would not do things and I would not sign up for things. And then I started really questioning. I was like, well, gosh, maybe I'm actually being a really horrible mom. You know, like I shouldn't be signing up to be the swim club president. Like that makes me a bad mom. And I mean, and so, you know, in the context of those 5 years, I mean, I just really, and obviously years before as well, I just lost myself in all of the shoving myself in a box. I mean, I spent so much time questioning, like, you know, did I, you know, cause him to get mad about, you know, the silverware and the wrong little things? Like, what did I do? Because I was the type that I was delegating to these four children. And if they put knives in the spoon thing, I was like, it's fine. We'll figure it out. Like, no big deal. Whereas he was much more like, you know, who did these dishes? And it was a big ordeal. Yeah.
So when I hear you share about that, it sounds to me, and I don't mean any offense here if this is inaccurate, but that you were married to a narcissist.
It's possible. I try not to diagnose other people. Do you know?
Yeah, well, I just did. So yeah. Sorry about that.
I mean, no psychologist, but yeah.
Nor am I. Yeah.
You know, we definitely had a different way of looking at things. And I mean, you know, there's certain things that I remember in the dynamic now, like if, you know, it would be hard to imagine if we ever get to what's going on now, where we've landed now. But I mean, at the time, like, you know, he would say things like, you need to do all the family grocery shopping during the week. I don't want to have to watch the kids on the weekend because I've worked all week. And so I don't want to have to. And I was like, excuse me, Like now I'm supposed to.
So what's interesting to me about this, whether we diagnose as this or not, like when I hear the walking on eggshells and the sort of the making you question your sense of self, who you're being, it makes me think that, again, I am not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist or anything, but that a strong, intelligent female lawyer, I think it's really important that people hear this, could get herself into a situation where she was questioning her self-worth and her worldview. Like, am I doing the right thing or am I not doing the right thing? So I'm curious about, from the level of awareness that you have now, looking back, what advice you would have given yourself in that moment to, would you have done anything differently? Yes. Okay. Let's hear about what you would do differently in that situation. And I'd also, well, let's start with that. Okay.
I would have sought help sooner, you know, with a coach or a therapist. I mean, now we have to remember this is 1995. I mean, no, 2005 was a hurricane. So 2005 to 2010 is when I was in Minnesota. You know, there wasn't the proliferation that we have now of social media and everything where you can just get all the information. I mean, I was one of those avid readers. I would go on Amazon and I'd find books. I remember the Should I Stay or Should I Go book, and I would read it and just be like, obviously I need to go. Like, this is such a no-brainer. But I was so stuck in the how can I leave and I get away? Like, I'm then free of this eggshell life, but then I'm literally putting my kids in it half the time. You know, who knows what percentage.
So how did you answer that? Because that's a really big question for people.
I stayed for years. I mean, I could not answer that. Like, I struggled with that big time. And I had a major, major aha thing in 2010, it was two things. I was sitting in a Caribou Coffee in the Twin Cities area studying for the bar exam because I had to get relicensed in Minnesota, you know, to be able to get back on my feet again. So there I am studying for the bar exam, 4 a.m. And my ex calls me about something and he was just livid. I mean, and he was like yelling on the phone. And this man next to me, sitting next to me after we get off the phone, and I just started crying. I just had tears like running down my face. You know, I wasn't sobbing or whatever, but I just had tears running down. And this man got up and he came and sat at my table and he said, I don't know anything about you. He goes, but I've seen you in here studying for your bar exam for weeks. And he's like, whatever is going on at home is not normal. And he said, for you to sit here and be screamed at 4 a.m. while you're studying for a bar exam is not supporting you taking the bar exam. And that was all he said. And he literally was like, I don't know anything and I don't need you to tell me anything, but I want you to know that that is not normal. And so he got up, he walked away, he left the restaurant. I left Caribou.
Did you ever see him again?
I did not. I actually stopped going to that Caribou. It embarrassed me.
I wonder if he was a bit of like a guardian angel, right?
Oh,
like a,
don't you think?
Like a messenger, right?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because when I got up and I left the Caribou, I decided to call a domestic violence resource center. And I mean, I was still crying. And I said, you know, I've never been hit. I mean, I've never been the subject of any kind of physical violence. I said, but something is just not right. Like, you know, it's this. And so I talked to that lady on the phone. And I mean, I'm an attorney at this point, but I wasn't practicing family law. My background was in insurance defense litigation. And so I talked with her. I got some really good insight. Then within, 48 hours, I was driving to a different Caribou. And I got an email from my ex that said, I have emptied our bank accounts. If you need prescriptions for the kids, gas or food, let me know. And that email will be forever burned in my brain and in my heart. I had a panic attack in the Caribou Coffee bathroom, just a flat out panic attack. But at the time, I didn't know. I thought I was having a heart attack. Like, you know, I started, my blood pressure was crazy. I was sweating. I mean, it was just, my heart was racing out. It was just this really bad thing. So I called a friend of mine who's an ER doctor, and he was like, you need to go to the hospital. So I drove myself to the hospital in this state. And, you know, they ran every cardiac test imaginable. And they were like, you're not having a heart attack. And a male social worker came into my hospital room and he literally just said, tell me what's going on. Like, something is going on. And I just broke down and really just kind of unloaded. And, you know, and he was like, yes, you've never been hit. He's like, but you're clearly in an abusive situation, whether it's emotional, financial, a combination, you know, whatever, like it is impacting you. And so, I mean, it's a long story because the bar was just 3 days away and they wanted to put me up on a heart monitor, not let me take the bar. And I was like, over my dead body, am I not going to that bar exam? Like, I was like, I am going. So I, you know, I
that's my ticket to freedom right
exactly.
there. Right.
Well, and it's interesting because our bank accounts were emptied. So my ex actually drove me to the hotel that I was going to stay in to take the bar exam, drop me off. I mean, I had no access to funds. And it is this, it's kind of amazing that I did it and that I did it successfully, but it was truly my ticket to change.
Yeah. So that's a pretty powerful story. There's a lot of detail there that's really I mean, that's trauma. Okay.
It was, you know? For sure.
And yet here you are on the other side. What advice would you have given the you then, right? Would you have left earlier? Would you have said, you know what, I would have been a better model to my kids? You know, 2020 hindsight is always, you know, the best, right? I roll my eyes here a little bit, but like, do you think it was the right decision for you to stay as long as you did?
I mean, I have to say, I tend to be the type of person, I try to not hold a lot of regret about the past because there's nothing mm-hmm. I can do about it. I try to instead look at it as, you know, that was the decision I made with the information I had at the time.
100%.
With my heart in the right place, in the sense of I wasn't, you know, at all divorce happy. Like, I wasn't the kind of person that's like, oh, I'll just get a divorce and get remarried. Or, you know, mm-hmm. like I grew up in a religious-based home where I was the first person in my entire extended family to get a divorce. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. I didn't go to that decision lightly. And again, like I said, I was very concerned about my children and what it would look like for them navigating what I perceived to be, and again, I'm not a psychologist, but what I perceived to be their father's just real up and down emotions, erratic anger. Like, I was like, these children are going to have a tough time. And I was in particular super concerned about my daughter, who had been very parentified both by me and her father, because she was kind of that perfect oldest child. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. just navigating her three little brothers. And I just was terrified about what that would look like, you know, in a different scenario. And without,
you really saw yourself as the buffer there.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, big yeah. time. Big time.
Yeah.
I was the buffer. So, I mean, again, like I say, the advice I would give, I needed more clarity sooner. Like, I needed to get more understanding of what an abusive relationship looks like, what boundaries look like, you know, more mindset work for myself around, I mean, because it's taken me years to get my mind back. Do you know what I mean? Like, to get my strength back and to get my confidence. And I don't mean to sound cocky, like, clearly I make mistakes and I need to, you know, check myself all the time, but I don't need to like check myself in, you know, whether the silverware is in the right drawer. Like, you know, I'm going to stick with the bigger issues, you know.
100%, right? There's a difference between second guessing your every move and having your sense of self decimated,
right?
Versus, you know, is this the right decision here, right? Huh. For right. There's a big difference. So now you live in Seattle and you're the owner of a law firm and you have lawyers working for you and that you've grown a successful business. And obviously, this personal journey has been a big part of why you chose family law as your area of specialty. How did you end up moving across the country to Seattle? And then additionally, like, does your story help you see the experience of your clients differently?
Big time. Yeah. Well, I mean, insofar as moving across the country to Seattle, when I was divorcing, I found out that a good friend of mine, he and his wife were divorcing as well. And they had actually lived down the street from us in New Orleans. So we had known them for years. And our kids were good friends. I was really close with his children, you know. And so when we both found out we were splitting up, then he came to Minnesota, visited me, and we've been together ever since. And he is from Seattle. And so when we sat down to figure out, you know, how were we going to blend our families, you know, we really looked at the ages of our children and what that was going to look like. And his were older. And so we decided that we would move. And at the time, my ex-husband, I mean, or, you know, soon to be ex-husband, he completely blessed that move. Like he, you know, he knows my current husband as well. Like they'd known each other forever. And so he was like, absolutely, you know, you and the kids should go to Seattle. Like that is fine. And he ended up moving to Seattle as well. And I mean, we have a completely different relationship now. And, you know, I mean, like today, right this moment, I am in a hotel and he is in my house on the Hood Canal caring for our pets. And actually one of our children is there with him. So, I mean, we have a totally different, you know, scenario now.
Obviously. I love that. Tell me more about that. I think this will be very inspirational for people because that the scenario that you shared of your marriage in particular post Katrina in the Twin Cities was abusive by your own definition. Absolutely. How did you get from abusive to this level of co-parenting that feels almost like friendship, the way you describe it?
Yeah, it's been a really interesting journey. I mean, much of it has to do with, I mean, my current husband is like the most just amazing evolved human. And he, I think very early on, because I was always looking to my ex to do the right thing, like pay child support or pay spousal maintenance or help me with any of the college costs or whatever. And that was never happening. And my current husband at some point just said, Elise, just stop. Like, stop expecting anything, like, because it's just not going to happen. So there's no point in you making yourself unhappy, just frustrated. He was like, just stop. And for some reason, that just spoke to me. And, you know, it was just this super calm, but like very matter of fact thing. And in that moment, I mean, I remember the moment when we had the conversation, I said to myself, I was like, I've got to figure out how to earn circles around my ex. Like, because he is never going to participate like the courts ordered or like any of our documents say. And I'm like, I was barreling down, you know, four kids going to go to college. And I was just like, what in the world am I going to do? So I put all my energy into, you know, starting my firm and figuring all that out. And at the time was totally motivated by, I need to pay for these kids to go to college. And I mean, I had, you know, college costs. I had kids in private schools in Seattle. I mean, I'm talking, you know, $250,000 a year in educational costs, kind of expenses that I had to figure out how I was paying. So I became pretty crazy and, you know, just worked and did my, built my firm. And in the process of all that, I had to do some massive personal development. Do you know what I mean? Like,
really? I do.
Massive.
Hey, Amira here. Want to know more about what keeps uber successful women from achieving everything they want in life? Find out more at theunstoppablewoman.com. Now let's get back to the episode. Okay, let's pause there for a moment because I want to dig into the personal development big time because this is a key like component to having a really great life and a really great business. You can't do it from a place of smallness or a lack of confidence or all the noise in your head. But I just want to call out one key thing, because I talk a lot on this podcast about desire and how desire is causative and it's a huge motivator that we can't do, like our dopamine pathways in our brain are all about like getting us motivated, and they have to do with desire. And you said, you know, once you flip the switch, oh, I'm not going to rely on him anymore. I'm going to, you said, earn circles around him. I love that phrase. Not because I'm anti-man, but like, I just love the idea of like you earning circles. Like, I'm like, oh yeah, let's do this. Right. Like I have a very strong stance that, you know, the reason people want to make more money is this feeling of freedom, right? Yep. And when you're trapped by not knowing how to earn it, it's a sucky feeling. So earning circles, love that. And then you had this big desire that was based in sending your kids to school, providing. Oh. And so you stepped into that provider archetype, which I think is really interesting. So I have a few follow-up questions on that. I want to dig into the personal development, but before we do that, I talk a lot about the masculine and the feminine essence. Okay. We as women who are driven, entrepreneurial, ambitious, tend to go into this provider archetype, which is a very masculine archetype, even though we're females and have both, you know, the masculine and the feminine in us. How did you navigate that? Was it ever a struggle for you in terms of like, okay, this is how I have to build my law firm, but I want to shift out of it and I'm having a hard time opening to my feminine? Or was that like easy peasy lemon breezy to you?
I think because I was involved in such an amazing new relationship at the time, and that opened up this unbelievable, I had never had it before, where I could be truly a feminine type, but I could also be strong. My strength does nothing to mess up my husband's sense of self. He is so comfortable with my strength. And so that was this very eye-opening thing to me, to be able to be this feminine, loving, like wife and mother and, you know, those typical kind of feminine things. And then also be very driven to do what I needed to do. But it's interesting because compared to other people, so outside of my husband, even though I was on this like, you know, growth path and really trying to get better, I have struggled. I mean, I would say to this day, of having, I mean, what I would call imposter syndrome around somehow feeling like the men in my arena know more. Like, and I would look to, you know, male coaches or male attorneys about things. And I would just always presume they know more. And it has been this, I mean, a real constant kind of struggle. I mean, I literally just had a conversation within a week with somebody, and I was saying this, and he was like, "Elise, are you kidding me? Like, how can you have imposter syndrome? Like, you've done really well. Like, you know, where is that coming from?" And I, it's something I'm really spending a lot of time thinking about, because there is some deep, I think, likely child, you know, kind of related. And some of it, you know, obviously, I'm not trying to knock the South, but growing up in that Southern Protestant, you know, you should be subservient to the men in the church, the men in your family kind of culture. I probably was raised with some, you know, of that. We nod along and we, you know, make sure we decorate like a Southern Living magazine and, you know, it's all supposed to be okay. Which goes really contrary to my strong side, you know, but it's there. I mean, I definitely am the type that I look to experts for things. I've now made a very conscious effort to look to female experts and to really be seeking out female experts, because one thing that, and I mean, I'm kind of slow on the uptake. One thing that has become so clear to me is my biggest superpower is just being me. Do you know what I mean? Like just being completely authentic me. And authentic me is this like super Southern, super hospitable, warm, you know, I love building community. I love gift giving. I love hosting people. I love hospitality. Like I love all those things, but that looks weird in a law firm, in a normal law firm. But I've come to understand I don't have to be a normal law firm owner. I get to just be Elise, the law firm.
I love that. I love that because then my take on authenticity, and you know, I have my good days and my bad days on this, right? Like I have my spectrum on like how transparent and vulnerable I'm going to be. But when you are authentically you, when you don't feel like you have to hide yourself, when you feel like you don't have to have a part of you that you're ashamed of or keeping secrets from the rest of the world, no one can hurt you because exactly. You're like, yeah, I own it. This is me. You know, like if you don't like it, okay, but it's out in the open. Totally. As opposed to if you feel like you have to hide something and you can't express yourself, you're not fully, truly who you are, then you feel like if someone finds out who I really am, they're gonna reject me, not like me, something bad is gonna happen, you know, I'm gonna lose my status in the world, whatever, right? And that is that just undermines your whole, not only your sense of self, but like your confidence in this world.
Completely. Well, and it's so disempowering. I mean, to have any kind of thing. I mean, I am so empowered by the thought and the reality that, and I feel very strongly that as a leader, I mean, I look in my firm and if I've got problems, they're all mine. I mean, they all can relate back to me and my leadership and whatever I need to work on. I find that super empowering rather than kind of having to rely on, you know, somebody else doing that work. I can really look at whatever system is in place, whatever I've done or not done. And I'm like, oh, look at that. Here's another area I can work on. And so that feels like, it, you know, not being a victim, I guess for me is, I mean, just absolutely huge. And when I think of the women, in particular women that I work with, you know, helping them to not be in that victim role through a divorce process is really transformational. I mean, if you can look at divorce as the catalyst to your personal growth, I mean, the sky's the limit. Like all the things that have been holding people back just get blown out of the water because it's like, I mean, when I was literally going through a divorce, you know, figuring out like, okay, I need you to give me, you know, $1,600 a month and this. I mean, now I'm like, whatever. I mean, $1,600 a month, $16,000 a month, whatever. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I look at it completely differently. I mean, I'm like, oh, you need help from me? Great. You owe me hundreds of thousands of dollars? That's fine. I'll be happy to help you. Like, you know what I mean? It's just, it has change my perspective on all things.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I want to ask you, you said you grew your leadership skills there. So what are, in the process of growing your law firm, what are some of the leadership skills that you learned that you could share, like a few, maybe one or two tips that you could share with people about how to be a good leader?
Well, I am definitely a servant leader kind of person. Like I'm one of those people, I don't have a hierarchical, you know, command and control kind of leadership style. I'm very much like, you know, how can I support and maximize the people around me so that they are becoming leaders and that they are leading their best lives? And part of that, at least for me in my law firm, has been, you know, dealing with people, I think has been both a difficult, bumpy journey, but also probably the one that has served for the most personal growth. You know, just truly understanding, again, like if I haven't trained somebody properly, if I'm looking at a problem and I turn that mirror on myself and I'm like, well, have you trained them properly? Have you been clear in your expectations? Have you then held them accountable clearly to those clear expectations? And if all those things haven't been done, I mean, obviously, I mean, this is a me thing, not a them thing. And so, you know, that then allows me to make improvements. And for me, as far as a leadership lesson is, when I see a problem, instead of ever blaming a person, I turn the mirror on myself and I figure out what is the underlying system that needs improvement.
Because oh, that's so good. Yeah.
Often it's a system that has failed. I mean, and I could be a major part of that system. Don't get me wrong. Maybe it's getting me out of the system that needs
totally.
To happen.
Totally. There's an adage that I heard years ago that I've like integrated and I love. Don't blame the person, blame the system, right? Yeah. And it just took it out of like that blame, like they're not doing a good job or they're not thinking properly, to like, well, what's the system? And that then makes you go, okay, 100% personal responsibility. I'm in charge of the systems. Yep. Until you're not, until you hire a COO or an ops person or whatever. But like, it's very clear that that's a key part of leadership. And so where did the personal development come into play? Like, have you always been someone who's been able to go, oh, I'm not going to blame them. I'm going to take personal responsibility. Okay. She's shaking her head. No. For those of you listening to audio, how did you make that transition? Cause I think this is a big one that holds people back in business, in their hiring and their successful hiring and their successful leadership. You know, we can't build a business on our own.
I have to tell you, my professional and personal development grew out of my parenting teens. My parenting a son, I mean, again, you know, you have these pivotal moments where I had a son who, you know, had moved to Seattle, you know, as part of this whole move, but he came to me in his freshman year and he asked to move back to Minnesota. He wanted to move back. He really just didn't think he wanted to live in Seattle, wanted his friend, best friend in Minnesota. They said they would have him come live with them. And it was a serious question he was posing to me. I mean, this was not a, you know, a super like sarcastic-y kind of thing or flippant. This was serious. I had to sit down and really evaluate, like, am I what's best for this child? Because obviously making a decision about what is best. This wasn't a Elise's ego. This wasn't even a, this is my child. I mean, and this is like hardcore stuff, like for the parents and the audience, like, you know, I mean, it is a big deal to ask yourself, am I the best person to rear my child in this current scenario? Well, I had to really evaluate that and really decide, like, you know, what was I bringing to the table? What could I bring to the table better? What could this other family bring to the table? You know, and so forth. And after several weeks, I mean, I decided that I was best for my son and that it was best for him to stay in Seattle. I also committed, though, to doing some real development because I realized that I would have these emotional things. And I realized that this was never going to fly, probably in general, but not with that child. That child was going to push every button I had. And if I could not learn to become the lowest heart rate in every room he and I sat in, I was never going to be able to successfully maximize him and lead him as a parent. And so I just went on a mission to learn, how do I become that lowest heart rate in every room? How do I not take things personally? How do I, you know, accept feedback, even if it's teen yelling feedback? How do I accept feedback in a non-offensive, non-offended, non-defensive way where I can take it, you know, distill it and flip it into something positive? And so
tell us one way you learned how to do that. Like, give us like a nitty gritty on like, how did you learn not to take it personally, right? We have to take 100% personal responsibility. It's such an interesting dynamic, right? 100% personal responsibility, but we can't take it, the stuff coming at us personally.
Well, I mean, with him, he had this way of like, if I was ever escalating, he would almost get like, I mean, snarky, and, you know, he would almost laugh. And I was like, oh, this is a thing here. I am creating this dynamic. I mean, in, you know, male, female, even too, like, you know, of that typical, like a male to be able to say, oh, she's just an emotional person. So I was like, oh, I am unemotioning myself and you are going to be the crazy one in this relationship. Like, and it became this real test of almost of wills between us, where he, because he, you know, typical teenager, tended to have big emotions and whatever. And I just, whenever he went up, I went down. And if he went up farther, I went down farther. And I mean, you know, sometimes he has said, like, you became almost robotic. But it was like, I had to, and I mean, obviously he's an adult now, he's like 26. And we've discussed, like, I mean, imagine had I not done that, if I met him every single time he went up, I mean, I can't even imagine where either of us would be now, you know? And I've watched his personal development, and it's absolutely mind-boggling to me to watch him now be able to accept personal responsibility and get feedback from, you know, he manages a bunch of people on job sites, and he gets feedback from people, and he'll be like, yeah, you know, they're probably right about that. I've had to step back and kind of think about how my behavior impacts them. And I'm thinking,
is this my son?
I know, my 26-year-old son. I'm like, you just go, mister.
Well, congratulations on that. That's awesome. So I think that's really interesting that, like, you had to learn how to modulate your natural, like, the feminine has, again, when I say feminine, I mean the feminine essence, not females, has that emotional wave, that movement, right? And you had to really step into the discipline, that masculine discipline, yep, of like, this is my choice right now, and really be determined about that, because there was a bigger goal, because there was a bigger need in the moment, and putting your son and his well-being first.
There. Well, and there was a need in our family, since, you know, their father wasn't in the home. They had their stepdad, who is like the coolest cucumber on the planet. Like, the man never, you know, has emotional reactions ever. But so they didn't need to see a juxtaposition of that. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm, especially raising three boys, those boys did not need to, I mean, I'm kind of a firm believer, and we women have to own what we're teaching our sons too. Like, we're, a lot of us want to complain about men in the world, and I'm like, well, how many men have you raised, you know, and what are, mm-hmm, you teaching them in your own home? Because I think that to allow that behavior to kind of go unchecked, and just, you know, for, if I were to just allow myself to be this kind of erratic, angry, upset, you know, whatever, I'm just feeding into a narrative that is so detrimental in the world.
The narrative about how women are, is that what you mean?
The narrative that men think women cannot, you know, do things, cannot control themselves, cannot handle their, you know, emotions. I mean, it becomes, when you're looking at a teenage son who's looking at a mom that's getting escalated, and they're like laughing and smirking, you just see the patriarchy in that. Do you know what I mean?
It's, I see. Interesting.
It is, yeah, a wild dynamic that I did not want to participate in.
So that's really interesting, because I have a different lens, but the way you shared that makes total sense. Like, the lens that I see is women have, in general, this is a generalization, not every woman, but a generalization that women have more of the feminine in them, and we have more of this emotional wave and this emotional cycle. Not all women, not, and it doesn't mean that men don't have emotions, because they do, but that we have this emotional wave, and that the rest of the world has to get good with that. Like, instead of us having to modulate that and put ourselves in a box, what if that was 51% of the world's norm, and that actually having emotions and expressing them instead of suppressing them, you know, not to the detriment, I'm not saying off the handle, yelling, screaming, disrespectful, but I'm having a big response to what's happening. Like, let's not try and make this milk toast right now. Let's 100% recognize that. Yeah.
But being able to do that in a way from a place of calm, I mean, and I don't, do you have children at all?
No, just four-footed ones.
Okay. Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
But no, I understand what you're saying. It's like, you don't want, you want to be able to express yourself
totally
in a responsive way, yep, not in a reactive, exactly, I'm a puppet kind of I've been tweaked kind of way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a major thing for me to learn to be able to say to my children, like, you have hurt me, you know, you have been disrespectful, or I am feeling very sad by what's happening. But to do all of that from a place of, I'm not offended by what's happened, because I can't get offended every time a 14-year-old does something. Like, I would literally make myself a crazy person.
Yeah, totally.
You know? And so being able to communicate those feelings and have those conversations, but from a place of, I mean, kind of like intellectual rigor too, you know, where we're not dumbing it all down and we're talking about our big feelings and how, I mean, I really tried to teach my children how their thoughts controlled their feelings, you know, and how, like, if you let your mind go in all these random ways, you are going to start feeling all these random things, and you can put a stop in that, you know, that thought part.
Yep. You can manage your mindset for exactly. Sure. And it's so huge, right? It's such a tool when you learn how to do that. And this is where I do think that the masculine essence really comes in play, because if you don't have the discipline to attend to that, it's going to run rampant, and you're going to be the puppet and really be pulled in a lot of different directions. Okay. Well, this, Elise, has been an amazing conversation. I want to ask you a few final questions, but before I do, if people want to look you up or find you, I know you have a podcast, where can they find you in this world? What's the best way to connect with you?
Probably just through our website at the Elise Bui Family Law. And, you know, I am a co-author of a book that has actually just got released, which is pretty exciting. The Tiger Tactics 2 CEO edition. So that is coming out. And we're actually doing some roundtable events, which will be a lot of fun. But yeah, I would say through that or through the Maximum Mom podcast, I would say those are the places.
I did not realize you were a co-author in the Tiger Tactics 2 book. Do you know Allison Williams?
Oh, very well. Allison has been a huge, huge factor in the work I've done and the growth I've had. Yeah.
She's amazing. So we can chat with, she's a good friend of mine and colleague. So let's wrap up this podcast by talking about, what do you feel makes your life exquisite right now?
Right now, I would say my wonderful husband. I always joke that second husbands are the best. He is just this amazing human, and we just, I don't know, just lead such a lovely life together. And the other thing that makes it exquisite is where we live. We live in this amazing spot on the water, and we get to enjoy all this natural beauty in Washington, which makes me so happy. I mean, every day I wake up to these wild sunrises over the water, you know, scoping out orcas and, you know, figuring out like where we're going to go hiking. And I kind of just love that.
I love that too. Beauty is such a big part of what makes life exquisite there. So then, flipping that question on its head, when you look at the entirety of your life, what would you like to attend to more deeply to make it that much more exquisite?
I would say my health. I mean, committing to my health in a way. I actually recently enjoyed a time with a group of lawyers, and the owner of that business, Michael Mogul, talked about his health journey over the last year. And it was so inspirational to listen to somebody who had gotten some bad medical news. And then he really committed, I mean, like truly committed to solving it, and did it with a business mindset. And I've been super intrigued by that. He, you know, got together a team of experts, you know, multiple medical professionals, physical therapists, nutritionists. Do you know what I mean? Like, got all these people together, then started measuring everything to figure out what was baseline, you know, then started doing iterations and then measuring more. And, you know, and it was fascinating to see. And I mean, he tracked this whole journey, and he has made such amazing progress. And I was like, that is so smart to actually think of our health the same way we do about our business. Like, it's, you know, when we're seeing a problem in our business, that is how we solve it. And it's like, why would I not do the same thing with my own
100%.
Body? So, yeah, my health. For sure.
That's next. Okay. Beautiful. Beautiful. And my last question for you today is, what do you love most about yourself?
That I wake up happy every single day.
That's huge. So big. Well, thank you, Elise, for sharing your story. I hope it's inspirational to many of the women listening that you have had this experience and have grown so tremendously from it. Not a victim, but unstoppable, and grown an incredible business helping, you know, passing it on, paying it forward, and really helping so many women. So thank you for joining us, Elise. It's been great having you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I love talking to you.
And thank you so much for listening and being part of our community and a loyal listener. Please like and subscribe and listen to our upcoming episodes. We have some great guests and some great teaching content. So I'm Amira Alvarez, founder and CEO of The Unstoppable Woman. And thank you so much for being with us here today. Take care. Most ambitious women I work with already have good lives, possibly even great. But there's often this one area that is fine as is, but not yet exquisite. And yet, when we unlock that one area, they access a whole new level. I want to personally invite you to book a complimentary call with me and discover what that unlock could do for you. These calls are for women who have done at least $1 million or more in their business or executive career and are ready for an exquisite life inside and out. You can book our conversation at theunstoppablewoman.com/connect.